Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to the Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good day, all. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, and you are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by Docs for Patient Care Foundation, promoting freedom of choice in healthcare. Please email us at doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. One more time, that's doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. How you doing this morning? I am doing fine, and I am going to leave for vacation as soon as this show is done, so I've got me a little short-timer fever, so I'll beg your forgiveness in advance if I have a few lapses of attention span. Part of my brain may already be on the shore watching the sand and the surf and all that kind of thing. But we're going to start the show with a bang. We're going to jump right into this. We're going to get your blood pumping, get your neurons firing. We're going to go right out on the edge here and flirt with the healthcare privacy laws a little bit and disclose a little bit of protected health information right here on the air. Fortunately, we're talking about my own protected health information as part of a story to make a point, so hopefully that's okay. We'll keep an eye out the window, make sure there's no federal troops or anyone else showing up here at the station. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about my own medical history to tell a story about technology and medicine. My point is, any medical technology, and since we're talking about health information technology, this is important. Any technology, medical or otherwise, no matter how apparently simple or how foolproof or how seemingly innocuous it can be, can have unintended harmful consequences. And in medicine, unintended harmful consequences are a very bad thing. So here we go. Here's my protected health information. Now, I happen to have a disorder called obstructive sleep apnea. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's a problem where when you fall asleep, your tongue and your palate and your tonsils and all that stuff in the back of your throat all kind of falls in on itself, and your airway blocks up and you can't breathe. It's kind of like snoring on steroids. It's worse than just a lot of noise. And believe me, as my wife can tell you, it makes a lot of noise. But it also cuts your airway off completely. And bad things can happen. Everything from falling asleep at the wheel to high blood pressure to other kinds of heart and lung problems. So it's a bad thing if you don't treat it. The good news is that you can treat it. And I have this machine. It's called a CPAP. And that stands for Continuous Positive Airway Pressure, CPAP. Very nice little technological device. It's just an air pump, really, and it blows air through a hose to a mask that you wear in your nose, and it keeps your throat open while you sleep. So it seems pretty simple, and it works very well. And, without going too far off the reservation, I'll tell you, it's been a very big life changer for me. But one night I had a problem. One night, middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that, I was awakened by the worst smell that you can possibly imagine. I mean, how bad does a smell have to be to wake you up out of a deep sleep? I mean, this was awful. I jumped up in bed. I couldn't breathe. I ripped the mask off, clawing for air, trying to get the purple haze to clear. And I said, what the heck happened to my CPAP machine? I looked down on the floor, and I was like, wow. I cannot believe that this happened. This is incredible. What the heck happened? Well, to tell you what happened, I have to give you a little background on a little different subject, which is the dog we used to have. Her name was Jade, and for 14 years, she graced our household with her presence and passed on after a long and productive life that made us all very happy. But in her later years, Jade had a habit of passing gas almost constantly. You'd always smell it. And occasionally you could hear it. So I looked down at the ground next to my CPAP machine, which is on the ground, and there's Jade. With her rear end parked right next to the air intake on my CPAP machine, and you can guess the rest. She passed a little colonic gift. The CPAP machine sucked it up, heated it, humidified it, and rammed it up my nose straight into my brain at 9 centimeters of water pressure. So that was a scary event in my world, let me tell you. We're not quite sure exactly how much brain damage occurred, although my wife and kids say I'm no worse off than I was to start with. But the point of the story is that it's hard to imagine that a machine that's just a very simple technology, it's just an air pump, could cause apparent brain damage, but there you go. And that's my point of the story, is that, you know, any technology can have unexpected, untoward side effects. And we see this all over history in other places, within healthcare and otherwise. You remember something about 30 years ago called the paperless office that was supposed to come along? This was about in the early 1990s, when personal computers were just coming on the scene and people were buying them and businesses were buying them, and the business literature was all over the place with the paperless office. This was coming any day now, because now, you know, an office worker who creates a document is going to not use any paper. They're going to type it on their what was at the time a green screen. They're going to type this out. They're going to put it on a floppy disk. And if you're old enough, you remember when there were floppy disks, and floppy disks were really floppy. They put that thing on a disk, and they, instead of walking a stack of paper to their coworker or their boss or their supervisor, they just take the disk down, and the supervisor would take the disk and read the document, and presto. No more paper. That's how it was supposed to work. And the prediction was so convincing at the time, in the early 1990s, this is when I was in residency training, that even paper manufacturers were in a panic. No one's going to buy any more paper. They're going to use computers. They're going to use disks. Well, if you're over 45 years old, you remember that that didn't happen. In fact, just the opposite happened. And the reason that it happened was because of an unforeseeable product of the interaction between humans and machines. It turns out, if you remember from back then, that it was easy to compose a document on a computer. And this was pre-Windows days. This was DOS days, if you have a background in this sort of thing. There wasn't even any Windows. Windows 3.1 was just coming around. And it turs out that you could compose a document on a screen, but nobody wanted to read the document on the screen. So the recipient, if you were to carry your disk around the corner to your boss and give them a sales report or some kind of other data on a disk, they weren't going to put the disk in the computer and read it. They were going to put the disk in the computer and print it. And as a result, paper use skyrocketed. It was just the opposite. Now, you know, every cubicle had a printer, or a multifunction machine. And it turned out that paper use went through the roof, doubled, tripled, more than that. Totally the opposite effect. And even now, 30 years later, if someone says, well, we're going to get an EMR system so our office can go paperless, well, that's still a pipe dream. It's still this ethereal concept. It's just something that people talk about. But, you know, we're not quite there yet technologically where anyone is actually going to get a paperless office. So even outside of medicine, we see that, you know, technology, when it comes along, the effect of that technology, the interaction between new technology and human beings is not predictable. And sometimes the predictions are 180 degrees wrong. And if you want to go inside medicine, we got all kinds of examples inside medicine of where technology created unexpected consequences. Anybody remember Fen-Phen, right? Miracle diet pill? Well, it turned out to be a miracle damage your heart valves pill. Right? Nobody predicted that. This is a drug that went through FDA, went through all the approval processes. Everything was supposed to be fine. Turns out it was a big problem, got pulled from the market. How about certain brands of hip implants that were made with cobalt? Right? There's still people out there with cobalt hip implants having a heavy metal toxicity because it turns out the cobalt leaches out of the hip implant, causes big problems. Even in my field, ear, nose, and throat, we had zinc nasal sprays that were supposed to fend off the symptoms of a cold. Well, it turns out if you spray zinc up your nose, you lose your sense of smell. All kind of issues where the technology coming on the scene, you think you know what it's going to do, turns out to do something unexpected, perhaps exactly the opposite of what you were expecting. And doctors understand this. Right? And when it comes to health information technology and electronic medical records, doctors understand this. And we understand, right? The IT people don't understand, and the government doesn't understand, but doctors understand that you can harm a patient just as easily with a computer as you can with a scalpel or with a bottle of pills if you don't know what you're doing. And when it comes to electronic medical records and health information technology, this stuff has been around for only a few years, historically speaking, and none of us knows entirely what we are doing, which is one of the reasons that you see this huge cultural disconnect between the folks in IT and the folks in government who think we have to have this stuff in our offices yesterday versus physicians whose ultimate responsibility is for patient welfare, saying let's slow down a little bit, let's move at a little bit more of – a cautious pace. And you have this problem like we talked about last week, where you get this unholy alliance between the government and health information technology saying we are going to use minimal data, essentially no data at all. We're just going to do this because we think it's a good idea and create this meaningful use program and force, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of physicians to adopt this stuff before we know what we're doing. So it comes as no surprise, like we talked about last week, where the satisfaction rate among EMR users has radically changed, right? In 2008, there was a very small number of electronic medical records users, but they were happy. Why? They had freedom of choice. They got to proceed at their own pace. They could be cautious. They were free to make decisions with their patients' welfare and, secondarily, their practice's financial health in mind. Meaningful use took all those choices away. Now, I don't know if you call that progress or not. I do not call that progress by any stretch of the imagination. Again, never in the history of medicine has the practice of medicine been affected by so many, have been affected to so many physicians and so many patients over such a small amount of time. And finally, we are seeing a little bit of recognition within the healthcare industry that maybe things got pushed a little bit farther. We are seeing that in stage two, which is now the first year of stage two, for meaningful use, right? This is where you get, you know, the meaningful use has three stages. I need to back up a little bit. Meaningful use has three stages. It has stage one, where you have to get your EMR and install it and do certain things and, unfortunately, practice medicine in a certain way, which is a big problem. And then you have stage two, where they raise the bar. Ironically, as they raise the bar in terms of what you need to do to jump through the hoop, the amount of money they pay you to jump through that hoop actually goes down. So no surprise that although everybody who's in the Meaningful Use program is supposed to be on board for stage two by the end of 2014 – it turns out that at this point, as of April, only 1% of all the people that have done stage one have attested to stage two. And there are, to the government's credit a little bit, some proposed rules on the table and a comment period that ends the 21st of July to spread that out a little bit and slow things down a little bit. And hopefully that goes through. But you see from stage one year one to stage two year two, a huge drop in the amount of people doing it, and then from stage one year two to stage two year one, an even higher drop. And I don't think there's going to be anybody left by the time the Meaningful Use program gets to stage three, because again, they're making it harder and harder to comply, and yet the amount of financial incentive to actually reach compliance is going down farther and farther. But finally, we're getting a little bit of recognition within the health IT industry that things are a little bit messed up. There was one quote from a leading person that said, well, perhaps there was a naivete among the policymakers' thought processes about how difficult it would be to change and adopt this technology this fast across the entire nation. And, you know, I'd say that would be kind of the understatement of the year, you think? So when we get back after the break, we're going to talk about this whole time question and how fast the healthcare industry has been forced to adopt versus how long it took other industries to adopt to information technology. We are on the break. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving three right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gano. Thank you, God bless Patriot Conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, and you are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about some historical issues regarding, you know, how much time medicine is being given to adopt this electronic medical records technology. And with a rather interesting story from my own personal life, we talked about how technology, as simple as it may seem and as how innocuous and seemingly harmless it may seem, that unintended harmful consequences can and do occur with all forms of technology, including those forms of technology which relate to healthcare. And part of what we were concerned about and remain concerned about is that the government and the health IT industry have come together in kind of an unholy alliance, in my opinion, to force the field of medicine to adopt technology far faster than is safe. So let's look at a little bit of history here, because we did talk in the last show about health information technology about a month ago about how the health IT industry, well, the IT industry in general, has some legitimate bragging rights about what they've done with other industries, such as the airlines and banking and grocery stores. And have said, yes, legitimately, they have transformed those industries. They are far more customer-friendly. The service is better. I think the bottom line for these companies is better as a result of the health information technology. But let's take a little historical perspective again. I like historical perspectives, and you're going to hear me talk a lot in the future about history because I think it makes a big difference. But let's look at the banking industry for just a minute. Now, the banking industry first started using computers to do what they do right around 1960. And if you look it up, you'll find that Bank of America took delivery of its first mainframe computer in 1959. Right, there's a picture of it you can find online. It's a great big thing. Probably runs on vacuum tubes. I'm not even sure there's any transistors around for production in 1959. But it was a great big, you know, 3-4 room size computer that that they took delivery of in 1959 to start keeping up with people's bank accounts and balances and deposits and withdrawals and all that kind of stuff. So let's see. So 1960, and then if you figure that internet banking came to be probably around the mid-2000s, about 2005 maybe. So do the math. That's about 45 years. 45 years from the time that the banking industry took its first computer in delivery to the time when the modern high-tech IT-driven banking age was born. 45 years. And this is for banking. Okay? Let's look at healthcare. Right? When did computers first begin to appear in doctors' offices? Well, about the time that PCs went for sale, plus a couple of years. So probably about the same amount of time, maybe 1995, about the time I finished training and got into regular private practice, is about the time when doctors' offices started buying PCs for simple stuff, word processing, that kind of thing. And that was also about the time when computers came into doctors' offices for strictly the financial side of a medical practice, the billing, the claim submission, that kind of stuff. Nothing clinical, nothing to have to do with taking care of sick people, just the financial piece of it, from the point the claim is filed with insurance to the point where the money's collected. So 1995, so if meaningful use is requiring the modern age of clinical medicine online to begin this year, say 2014, you're talking about 19 years. So you're talking about less than half the time And some would argue that the number shouldn't even be 19 years that we compare. It should be 5 years, because that's the meaningful use schedule of having the entire industry of medicine, or the practice of medicine, going from 4% computer usage to theoretically 100% computer usage in 5 years. So you can use 19 years as a number, or you can use 5 years as a number, but either way, it's a whole lot less than the number of decades the banking industry got between the time they first touched the computer to the time when the modern internet-driven age of banking has begun. So how come the banking industry gets 45 years, and at best, healthcare gets less than half of that amount of time? And by some measurements, maybe a tenth of that amount of time or less. So if you consider the healthcare is far more complicated than banking. I mean, banking is child's play. I mean, no diss to the bankers who may be listening, or the financial folks who may be listening, but banking is child's play compared to healthcare in terms of the potential for error and the potential for harm in serving your customers or serving your patients. And it's just, we see this naivete, again, like some folks in healthcare are finally starting to admit, or in health information technology, are finally starting to admit that, yeah, these people inside the Beltway who wrote these crazy meaningful use, had a naivete, and in my opinion also an arrogance. I mean, it was worse than naivete. Naivete is a kind term for what for their attitude. I would call it a lethal combination of ignorance and arrogance among the folks inside the Beltway, who thought that they could not only tell us how fast we had to adopt information technology with no regard to patient safety or efficacy, but also thought they knew how to tell us how to practice medicine, because buried in the meaningful use regulations are a bunch of what they call quality reporting guidelines. So that's a Trojan horse for, we're going to tell you how to practice medicine, and this is just the beginning, right? This is the frog in the pot of boiling water concept. Start off with just a little bit of intervention in how to tell doctors how to practice medicine. But clearly, if the folks who are big advocates of big government have their way, that's going to get ratcheted up as the years and the decades go by. Now, you might think, after listening to me rant and rave last time about a month ago and all the talking I'm doing today, you might think that my conclusion, or my advice to you physicians in the audience, would be don't get an EMR. You might guess that. Right. You might think that I would say stay away from this stuff. It's a bad thing. The government's all involved, and that's a bad thing. But you haven't heard me say that. You have not heard me say that EMR is a bad thing. Right? In spite of the fact that EMRs aren't user-friendly, in spite of the fact that they're designed to serve the needs of government and not physicians and patients, in spite of the fact that we're being forced to buy them, in spite of the fact that the meaningful use payments, $44,000 per doctor over 5 years, that money doesn't come close to the expense per physician over 5 years for EMR. In spite of the fact that the folks using EMRs now, as we've demonstrated with data, don't like the systems they're using, you might think I'd tell you, don't get an EMR. In fact, the rest of the show today, we're going to talk about why I think you should get an EMR if you do it right. And that's not easy. It's harder to do it right now than it was to do EMR correctly 5 years ago, because now the government's created this environment where they have attempted, somewhat successfully, unfortunately, they have attempted to define what constitutes successful use of an EMR. But their definition of successful use of an EMR is not going to allow you to truly succeed and truly leverage the benefits that electronic medical records offer. Right? Our practice is in its 10th year with electronic medical records. We just started our 10th year. 9 years ago, this month, we flipped the switch on ours and made it available to the physicians who wanted to use it, and had a very gradual implementation that we'll talk about in a future show. But what I'm going to do next is talk you through the numbers that document pretty clearly that we save with our electronic medical record system. Hey, this doesn't count meaningful use, but we save about $25,000 per physician per year using EMR over paper. And I'm going to try to show you through all these numbers why you'd almost be crazy not to have one. Okay, this is a completely different mindset than I've talked about in the last show and a half. But I'm going to walk you through this. Now, you know, in order to do that, there's a couple of things that you've got to do for me mentally as we do this. The first is you got to separate yourself mentally from all this government crap and health IT industry crap that's telling you you have to buy one because the government says you have to buy one and you have to use it the way the government says you have to use it. When we implemented our EMR and got this 25,000 savings per year, this was before meaningful use came along. So we had a much cleaner sheet of paper to work with in terms of doing this in a way that we always kept our eye on the ball. We knew when we bought our EMR that the whole point was return on investment. Right. It wasn't government, jumping through hoops that the government had created. It was to make it work for us and make it work for our patients. So now I'm going to walk you through those numbers. Right. We're going to find out, and I'm going to let you know why, how we got to this number of $25,000 per physician per year. Now, the savings comes in three forms. The first is direct savings. This is absolutely documentable. You can't argue with the numbers. This goes straight to the bottom line. That's direct savings, dollar for dollar. The next category is space savings, right? When you get your EMR implemented, you can get by with less space. You can send a lot of the folks who don't touch patients in your office, the financial folks, the billers, the collectors, you can send them home, let them work from home, and leverage all kind of financial benefits by that. And then finally, we have savings in FTEs, right? You can either reduce your payroll or you can redeploy the folks that are stuck doing things because of paper charts and redeploy those folks to make your patient care better, to make your patients happier and give you, you know, better care, better customer service, all the things that we want to do, but, you know, unfortunately have our hands tied because of the way paper records work. So we save about $25,000 per doctor per year. Now, that's offset. I mean, there are expenses, obviously, involved in having an EMR, everything from, you know, the wide area network that you have to maintain, the routers, the switches, the terminals in the exam rooms and in the doctor's work areas. And, you know, we probably eat up two-thirds of that $25,000, but I'm pretty confident that we are significantly better than break-even if you subtract the expenses from the savings. But if you look at $25,000 per doctor per year and compare that to the Meaningful Use program, right, Meaningful Use pays each physician $44,000 over 5 years if you make it all the way to 5 years. That's best case scenario, you get $44,000. With the doctor savings, right, simple arithmetic, 25,000 times 5, you get $125,000 per doctor per year, per doctor over 5 years, which is a whole lot better than that $44,000. So let's break down those categories one at a time. First, we're going to talk about the direct savings. And this is the lowest hanging fruit that is on the tree in terms of saving money. And we'll get partway through this, and then we'll have the break. How much do you think a doctor spends every month on medical transcription, right? After a doctor sees you, they retire to their work area, or some people do it in the exam room with the patient, which is a good idea, and dictates that note into a little dictaphone, a little, you know, handheld tape recorder. And then that little cassette tape or the digital file comes out of there and goes to a transcriptionist, and they type the note up, and then it comes back, and you sign it, and you put it in a paper chart. That's how it works. That is a very, very expensive process. Transcription is charged between 10 and 12 cents a line. That comes out to several dollars per document. And a busy physician is going to spend probably about $1,000 per month in transcription. With EMR, that goes away. There is no more transcription to pay, and our transcription costs went from probably about $150,000 per year to zero. So that's an easy one to appreciate. And that is the lowest hanging fruit. It's very easy to see. And as soon as you get rid of transcription, you know, the money is in your pocket. The other hard dollar for dollar savings that you get is going to be paper chart supplies. Because remember, that paper chart is expensive. You're paying for the paper. You're paying for the manila folder. You're paying for the dividers. You're paying for the little stickers that have the first three letters of the patient's last name. If you go through that arithmetic, you're going to save about $2,200 per doctor per year. I'm talking too much. We're coming up on the break. You are listening to America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that wellness and prevention is the key to living a long and healthy life? For example, Common diseases such as acid reflux, high cholesterol, non-insulin-dependent diabetes, and high blood pressure, in some cases, are caused by poor nutrition. Scientific studies suggest the use of nutritional supplements, a healthy diet, and exercise can control and, in some cases, prevent disease. Use nutritional supplements that are formulated using good manufacturer practice standards. And remember to let your doctor know what you are taking, since it can react with prescription medication. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
Membership. Are you an IHC member? Access to the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism's breaking news, industry trends, expert blogs, and networking with IHC's industry-wide member community. IHC membership puts you at the focal point of the dynamic health and benefit industry, allowing you to join the conversation and collaborate with industry stakeholders and your peers. Your IHC membership includes a subscription to Healthcare Consumerism Solutions Magazine, Healthcare Exchange Solutions Magazine, annual publications Healthcare Solutions Superstars, and Healthcare Solutions Outlook, a free white paper, and much more. Sign up as a free IHC member or $99 premium IHC member today at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am Dr. Mike Karuchak, and I am delighted that you have chosen to spend some time today listening to us. At the end of the last segment, we had just gotten into the itemized breakdown of how electronic medical records, if you do it correctly, and if you mentally separate yourself from all the government and industry garbage that has clouded the picture, if you just take that EMR and you buy it and you put it to work for you, not for anybody else, not for the government or anyone else, you put it to work for you and for your patients, that you can save about $25,000 per physician per year. And we were just breaking that number down. So the biggest one is transcription. We talked about that, and, you know, any doctor who, you know, makes it their business to sign their own checks as you pay the bills knows that you're spending between $750 and $1,000 per month per doctor on transcription. So any large practice is going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars per year on transcription, and when you get your EMR up and running, that goes away, period. The second category of hard dollar-for-dollar savings is all the supplies that you buy, manila folders, dividers, all that kind of stuff to maintain paper charts. Every time you make a new paper chart for a new patient, it costs you about $1.20 in materials alone. That doesn't count the labor of somebody to put it together. So you're talking about another $2,200 per doctor per year. So now we're up to about $14,000 and a little bit of change on top of that per year. And that's just the hard dollar-for-dollar savings. The next thing we're going to talk about is the space savings. After a couple of years of electronic medical records, you don't need a file room anymore, right? So how big is your file room? How big is the room that you are using to keep all your paper charts in? Usually that's probably about 100 square feet at least. If it's a big office, it's going to be, you know, bigger than that. When you get rid of all your paper charts, and that takes a couple of years, then you know, you're going to save 100 square feet, $25 per square foot at least. In some medical office spaces, $35 per square foot. But do the math there, and you get about $1,400 per doctor per year. Then we have the concept of teleworking. Right? This is where, because electronic medical records allows you remote access, right, I can be anywhere on the planet and I can access my patient's charts. You can have a lot of your staff work from home. The folks who don't touch patients for a living can work from home. And you can free up that space in your office from non-revenue generating space to revenue generating space, exam rooms, ancillary services, that kind of stuff. And you can start making money with that space, or you can grow your practice without having to pay more rent. Right? What's the two biggest things that doctors' offices, practices have to pay for? Payroll and space. So we're talking about significantly reducing both of those. And if you just look at the space savings, you're probably talking $1,000 per doctor per year. So now we're up to about $15,000. The rest is a little bit more ethereal, and it involves a little bit more sort of assumptions in the arithmetic, that kind of thing. But one of the biggest things that EMR can do for you, if you set it up correctly, which takes a lot of effort and a lot of time, if you set it up correctly, you can have it do a lot of your paperwork for you. This is probably a little more important in surgical practices than it is in non-surgical practices, but when we offer a surgical option to a patient and they choose to accept that option, we have a whole bunch of stuff that needs to be generated. We have consent forms, we have information forms, we have history and physical forms, all that kind of stuff. With paper charts, you have to pay a human being to fill out all those forms. And we did a little bit of rough arithmetic a few years ago to figure this out. It's probably costing you about $6.50 every time that you have somebody generate the paperwork to get somebody to the operating room. So we do about 400 cases per doctor per year. You do the arithmetic and you're saving another $2,500, $2,600 per doctor per year. Then we have the employee savings, right? And this gets back to the teleworking thing, because when you have somebody work from home, not only do you get that space freed up to do something else with in the office, but your employee is very happy because they don't have to come to work anymore, right? How much time and how many hours per year do people that have to commute to work lose and waste sitting on the road? How much dollar, you know, how much per mile does it take to operate a vehicle? You can give your staff a raise, a significant raise, right? After tax dollar raise without spending an extra cent in payroll. Makes you more competitive to get better people, whole shoot and match. So you're going to add another $12,000 to the total, or another, you know, $2,400 per physician. And then we have to talk about something a little more ethereal, and we're going to get into this whole thing about the art and science of workflow. But if you automate workflows, and we're going to get into what that means. So if it sounds a little weird to you now and you don't understand this piece, bear with me another 5 or 10 minutes, and we're going to tell you what workflows are like. But if you automate workflow, that means putting the computer to work for you, putting the EMR to work for you, having it do the stuff that humans don't have to do, is probably going to get you about, and this is a big number, I'm going to show you how we get there, but about $8,500 per doctor per year by automating workflows, saving on payroll because you don't have to pay human beings to do that stuff anymore. And that's how we get to a number that is roughly $25,000 per physician per year. And again, that's without meaningful use. We're just talking about what happens purely in terms of a benefit that you're going to get year after year after year forever. But the kicker here is you've got to make this happen, right? This is not going to happen by itself. You know, the CEO of our company, Dr. Pablo, he says it well. He used to call it closing the loop. And that means that you can't just do this halfway. If you just get your system and you plug it in and you turn it on and you pay all this money to get it working and you don't close the loop and say, okay, we're going to move staff from the office to home. We're going to stop using transcription and make that a policy. We're going to do all these things to make sure we get that. We're going to look at the file room and thin out the paper charts and put them in storage and, you know, put a cubicle in that space where the file room used to be, which, by the way, is exactly what we did. If you look at where our file room used to be, we got two cubicles there. We got two human beings working in there. And so we've utilized that space better. But you have to go out and do these things. They don't happen by themselves. And that is not intuitive. Nobody tells you that. When we did our EMR, there was nobody giving that advice, and still there's nobody giving that advice. So I've talked to you about the numbers. I've talked to you about the why. Why should you get an EMR? You know, after you mentally separate yourself from all the government crap and meaningful use crap and look at EMR as a concept rather than all of the white noise that has now clouded the picture. There are 25,000 good reasons per doctor in order to get an EMR. So there's the why. So now we're going to talk about the how. And to understand the how, there's two things you got to do. One of them we've talked about, and I'll say it again and again. I'll probably say it 10 more times before the end of the hour, which is you got to forget about all the meaningful use stuff, the government stuff, all the crap that the health IT vendors are doing, and just think about the concept of how you leverage information technology to work for you. So that's the first thing you need to do. The second thing that you need to do, and this is even harder, is you docs out there need to develop a new skill. And it's not a skill that anyone, unless it's happened very recently in medical education, this is not a skill anyone talked about during medical school or residency, right? Medical school and residency, for those of you who aren't docs, is purely focused, as it should be, purely focused on how to make sick people better, right? Because that's our job. And in the old days, that was all we had to do. Medicine was the calling. That's what you did. Every professional and extracurricular moment that you could spare was devoted to the art and science of making sick people better. Unfortunately, for better or for worse, we had no control over this. Don't shoot the messenger here. But unfortunately, these days, that is simply not enough. If you're going to make this work, if you're going to bring your practice into the 21st century, you've got to acquire a new skill set. And that skill set is called workflow management. Right? There's other synonyms for this. And this is what we went to med school to avoid. I mean, this is not pleasant stuff to look at. What is workflow? Well, they call it other things. They call it business processes. If you look in the business literature, which is unpleasant, but I've tried to do it the best I can, they got a bunch of different terms for it. But, one thing that it all has in common is this is what the econ majors were doing, right? When we were in pre-med, this is what the econ majors were doing. This is what the management majors were doing, the business majors. And, I tried to take a few of these courses when I was in college to get some idea of what was going on. And quite frankly, none of it made any sense to me at all back then. And I kind of walked away scratching my head saying, what do you get out of a management course? Because I certainly don't understand what it is. 30, 40 years later, I'm a little bit more enlightened. But it's easy to say, look, I'm a doctor. I treat sick patients for a living. I don't want to deal with all that other stuff. The problem is that's not enough. And if you look at history, you can see examples, right? 50 years ago, 50s and 60s, what happened 60 years ago? Well, doctors said, you know what? We're doctors. We're not hospital administrators. Back in the old days, doctors ran hospitals. And there was no conflict of interest between the people taking care of the people that were taking care of the patients were the same people that were administrators. And so there was no conflict of interest. They were the same people. But 50 years ago, we said, we're not going to do that. I'm a doctor. I'm not a business person. We're going to give that control up. And as a result, again, unintended consequences. Many times, hospitals and doctors find themselves on opposite sides of an issue because they're not the same people anymore. 50 years ago, we made a mistake. 30 years ago, 20 years later, we made another mistake when it came to managed care. We said, I'm a doctor. I don't have any interest in reducing what it costs to take care of a sick person. Medicine's expensive. Pay up. I'm not going to think about this. So what happened? Well, politically, socially, business-wise, we had our heads handed to us because we didn't play. We didn't engage an issue that didn't directly involve sick people. And every year, for the last 50 years, we failed. And again, this isn't a conservative issue. It doesn't matter what your political interests are. Doctors, regardless of your political feelings, nobody has gotten involved in Washington until recently. And, clearly we've all paid the price for that. And, back in the, a few years ago when some of us started making trips to Washington, the first thing that we heard from the people we met with was, where have you been? And again, I'm not talking about conservative or liberal or Democrat or Republican. This applies across all parties. So history is replete with examples where doctors failed to engage and failed to think beyond the exam room and the operating room. And, we still face that problem today, but it's time to wake up, folks. Docs that you are listening to me, within the sound of my voice, you've got to wake up and realize that you have got to get involved. This is, the survival of our profession depends upon folks getting beyond the exam room, beyond the operating room in the doctor's office, and realizing you've got to move out of your comfort zone. EMR presents us with the same dilemma, right? 5 to 10 years ago, same thing. Nobody wanted to get involved with electronic medical records and health information technology. And again, conversations in Doctor's Lounge, right? Name of the show is the Doctor's Lounge. This is a conversation I've had on several occasions in a real doctor's lounge at a real hospital where I try to get people involved. And unbelievably, the response I would get was, well, I'll do electronic medical records when the government makes me do it. I'm not even going to think about it till then. Well, that's just great. So you thought that the government was going to give you a well-reasoned, intelligent program that was going to make all this very simple, when it turns out it's just the opposite. So this is my plea. You know, if there's anyone out there beyond which I'm preaching to the choir, you've got to get involved with this. You've got to get fired up about this. And right now, EMR is the current battleground. You know, the whole hospital control thing, that's in the past. Managed care, that's in the past. Politics is an ongoing thing. But EMR, I think there's still time, especially now that there's some recognition within the health IT industry that maybe meaningful use wasn't such a great idea, or at the very least, it's time that it was rolled back or scaled down, it's time to get involved, and this may be a window of opportunity for us to get in the battle. We're coming up on the hard break. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
Watchdog is a term given an organization like the United States Justice Foundation, which since 1979 has been watching out and, when necessary, taking the appropriate action, from testifying to litigating to protect our constitutional rights. USJF, a nonprofit organization, is nationally recognized not only as a watchdog, but many in the government, as well as those involved in legal cases, have also called the USJF a bulldog, for the tenacious approach in their presentation and proof of what is right. Find out more at www.usjf.net. Support USJF as they support you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchek, and I am very grateful that you've chosen to spend a little time with me today. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. One more time, that's doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. At the end of the last segment, I was kind of in the middle of issuing a battle cry to my fellow physicians to get involved, to get out of your comfort zone of just patient care only, and you need to learn some new things. And the context of that was that if you are going to get an EMR and use it successfully, that you're going to have to learn some new skills. And the skill that we're going to talk about right now is workflow. We started talking about it in the last segment. We're going to finish that out in the last segment of the hour today. We're going to talk about workflow. So what is workflow? It could be called business process management. It's got a bunch of other boring, you know, acronyms. And this stuff is, sadly, this stuff is so boring to try and learn. I bought a book on workflow modeling about 3 or 4 years ago. It's about 400 pages. I've owned the book for 4 years, and I've read about 50 pages if I'm lucky. It's a great way to fall asleep at night. I get through about 2 pages, and I wake up about 30 minutes later having fallen asleep without my CPAP machine on, feeling like somebody's got a pillow over my head, but we already talked about that. But the bottom line is, as boring as this is, you got to learn it. You got to get out of the driver's seat of your practice and get and pop the hood and get underneath and start tinkering with the engine. And part of doing that is getting the workflow. So what is workflow? Well, workflow is the series of steps required to get a very mundane task done. For instance, let's say you see a patient, you're in the exam room talking to him, and you decide you want to order a chest x-ray. Right, common thing, we all do it. So what are the steps? Well, step one is you turn to your medical assistant or your nurse and you say, this patient needs a chest x-ray, please get them a chest x-ray. And at that point, your involvement as the doctor is over, right? You don't want to touch that again until you've got a result in your hand. But the point is, there's a bunch of steps that have to happen in order to get from telling your assistant you need a chest x-ray to getting the order in your hand. So what are all those steps? Well, they have to fill out a form and send it to the radiology facility and get your note from that day that documents the need for that exam and send that to the radiology facility. Then it gets scheduled. Then it gets done. Then the report gets done, and the report gets faxed or sent by some manner to get back in your hands. But the point is, all those little steps require a lot of engineering if you're going to do them correctly, and once you figure that out, then you can use the EMR to automate a lot of those steps. And the best example that I can think of comes from our practice. And it has to do with how we handled phone calls in the paper chart age, 10 years ago, versus the electronic age with our EMR. Now, back in the old days, we did not have a formal workflow for phone calls. We did not have the phone system set up to efficiently handle patient phone calls. And as a result, we got more complaints about unanswered patient phone calls. Again, this is 10 years ago. We got more complaints about patient phone calls not getting returned than we should have. And the reason was we had no formal process in place. It was random. They would call the main number for the office. It would roll around until somebody picked up a phone. And then who knows how you'd get the message. Someone might walk back and get you out of an exam room, even though they didn't have to. Or they might give you a sticky note, or they might take it in one of those phone message logs with the blue and the yellow for the two copy things. But there was no control. There was no thought behind the process. There was no workflow. It was informal. It was ad lib. And one particular day that scared the death out of me was, a day that I was in the OR and I wasn't in the office. I came back the next day for office hours, and there was a phone note on my desk that a patient had called after an operation concerned about bleeding. And I was like, well, geez, this is bad. I went out and I said, did anybody handle this phone call? Well, fortunately, the patient called back a second time and they got handled. But the point was, without a formal workflow in place, somebody in the front office who answered the phone just stuck a message on my desk and didn't think about the urgency of that message. And it drove home the point that, man, we have to have a way of handling this stuff. Typically, our response as a physician to this kind of thing is to grab your administrator and, take her out behind the woodshed and say, this has to be done better and we have to clean things up and we trust our administrators to handle this, but in this day and age, that's not really enough. So let's look at what our practice did to fix phone call workflow with the EMR. Now, the EMR does two things for you that is very important here. One is that it allows access to the chart from anywhere. And allows communication, secure communication between the people answering the phone and the people who need to fix the problem. So we were able to centralize the workflow. And this also requires, and this is a very important caveat, is if you're going to make an EMR work well for you, you need to have a very sophisticated phone system working in parallel with that EMR. So we came up with a formal workflow, wrote it down, taught it to everybody, and we continue to supervise it today. Is we assigned one person all of the patient questions that came in. Any patient who called for anything besides an appointment goes to one person. That's Pam. She's great. She's been with the practice for many years. We trust her judgment. She knows what she's doing. But she picks up those calls, and then she'll triage those calls in one of several ways. If it's something mundane, like maybe a prescription refill gets to her or something, she'll handle it herself after looking at the chart. The beauty is she can look at any chart from any office. We have five offices. She can look at any chart from any office. So this whole idea of faxing stuff back and forth or trying to route the call to somebody who can see the chart, that all goes away, and the workflow becomes very smooth. So she handles the calls in one of several ways. If it's low-end, it's prescription refill, something like that, then she'll just handle it herself. There's a variety of options up to, something urgent. The patients, this phone message I got 10 years ago about a patient, bleeding that I didn't get. If she gets that call, she knows to pick up the phone and call me wherever I am and say, hey, we got a problem here. You need to either meet this patient in the ER, get to the office. So that's the other extreme of the triage. But she's able to communicate through the electronic medical record system in a totally secure way. Doesn't matter how inconvenient HIPAA gets. If you're sending a flag inside your electronic medical record system, that's secure. But we're able to handle phone calls much more efficiently. The complaints that we were getting basically went away because not only did we have an efficient way of handling it, but now we had a very solid audit trail inside the EMR. So here's a situation where everybody wins. Patients get better service. Doctors have more confidence that their patients' concerns are getting addressed. We have an audit trail, and we probably saved about one FTE because we didn't have to have people answering patient phone calls in every office. They all got routed to one central person, got filtered, triaged, and so we were able to handle patient phone calls with less human intervention, so we saved money, and the patients got better service, and the doctors were happy. So it was a win-win-win all around. And that's the kind of example that I think is most illustrative about how EMRs make workflow better and how you can use EMRs to save money and do the job better all at the same time. So we're going to delve into this workflow thing a little bit more deeply and talk about some tough concepts. It's tough to do this on the radio. I can't see you. You can't see me. So we're going to go slow, and I'm going to wave my hands a lot, and we're going to try to get through some of these more difficult concepts regarding how electronic medical records helps your practice through better workflow, through more efficient workflow, and through automation of workflow. Once you figure out how you want to do things, you make the darn computer do the work. So the machines serve us, not the other way around. So let's talk about an example. This is America's Web Radio has neat shows, car shows, right? We had a car show going when I came in this morning. I've got an old car myself sitting in storage, and one of these days I'm going to get it fixed up and run it again. But let's start with a car example. We're going to talk about workflow. Let's say that you got a car that needs new tires. And you live in a small town in America, and the only shop that you can get your tires changed is a one-man mechanic shop, right? Like the old days, right? One-man mechanic shop. So you go in there and say, I need new tires, and they're happy to do that, but it's going to take them a few days to do it because there's only one man in the shop. So how's he going to get your tires changed? This is going to be an example of what's called sequential processing, where steps can only be done one step at a time, and only one workflow can be done at a time. So you leave your car at the one-man mechanic shop. So what's he do? Well, he probably doesn't have your tires in stock. So the first thing he has to do is order your tires. While he's ordering your tires, your car is sitting there and nothing's happening. So then the tires come in, puts the car up on the rack, and he's got to work on one tire at a time. So he takes the right front tire off, takes the wheel off, takes it over to the back, takes the old tire off, puts the new tire on, balances the tire, sticks it on. He can't work on the second wheel till he's done with the first wheel, because there's only one person working at a time. So that's sequential processing, right? If he gets any interruptions, if he gets a phone call, he gets an emergency, somebody needs towed, he's got to leave the garage, whatever, that workflow has to stop. And he's got to go and do something else. That's sequential processing, and it's very slow and it's very inefficient. He might forget whether he balanced one tire before he puts it on if he gets interrupted. Sequential processing, very inefficient, very slow. That's what paper charts do. Paper charts force you to do sequential processing. Now let's look at another kind of processing called parallel processing, where more than one workflow, more than one task, can be done at the same time. So think about an Indy car, right? They're going around the track at 200 miles an hour. Their tires are wearing down. What happens? They pull into a pit stop. What happens at a pit stop? 8 people descend on this car and change all 4 tires all at once. And at the same time, they're cleaning the windshield. They're putting gas in. They're taking care of giving the driver a drink. They're doing all this stuff. And if all that stuff takes longer than 8 seconds, that pit stop is considered a failure. They didn't do their job fast enough. So you got 8 seconds versus a week for the single mechanic in the garage, because he's one guy. And that is what EMR allows you to do with your medical practice, is that you can have multiple workflows going on all at the same time, and those workflows don't get in the way of each other. We'll close with just an example. We'll carry this parallel processing over to the doctor's office. So let's say that I'm seeing a patient and they need their thyroid out, one of the most common things I do. So we offer them the surgical option. They choose to accept the surgical option. There's about 4 or 5 different workflows that all have to start at the same time, okay? If you do it on paper charts, all those workflows have to happen one at a time, right? Step one, got to get the chart note back. That's transcription, paying all that money, getting the note back. Nothing else can happen until that happens. After that, you can send the note to the insurance company, get the approval, get it scheduled, all these sorts of different workflows. If they need to see a cardiologist before their operation, get cardiac clearance. All right, the doctors know what that is. Make sure their heart's safe for the operation. None of those things can happen at the same time. With paper charts, they all have to happen one at a time, because that paper chart can only be in one place at one time. With EMR, you can turn 5 or 6 people loose on that chart at the same time, because with EMR, the chart can be in 5 people's hands all at once. So you don't have to wait for the insurance approval to come back or for the cardiologist to see the patient. You can start doing all these other things because they're all happening. You know, my surgery scheduler works from home. She's got access to the chart. My nurse works in the office. She's got access to the chart. And so you can make all these things happen at once, at the same time automating the paperwork like we talked about before. So scheduling an operation is 10 times easier and 10 times more efficient with electronic medical records versus the paper chart. Not only is it more efficient, it's more reliable, right? Let's say I got a scheduler working on the chart. I got a nurse working on the chart. They're all competing for the chart, right? If my surgery scheduler has a stack of paper charts that she's trying to get surgery scheduled for, and the nurse pulls a chart off the rack, now my workflow for the scheduler fails because she doesn't have the chart anymore. We're coming up on the end of the hour. We're going to finish this up my next show in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge at AmericasWebRadio.com.